exercises for warming up our ways of communicating.
From the program of Lincoln Center's White Light Festival for the performance of the Ensemble Bassiani in 2019. The program reads, "The Georgian Supra table party usually begins with a Mraval Zamir. This lifts the spirits of everyone at the table and creates a festive mood. As the voices rise, so does the collective enthusiasm and spirit of those sitting at the table, making them feel that their meeting will become a celebration." From the text of the song itself, "Let us sing together, brothers, while we see each other. There will be time for mourning, when we will be lying under the ground, with earth on our chests. I love you, sweet Kakheti, big grove on the banks of the Alazani River. Deer on the pastures, straw on the banks of the Ori River." This is Tongue in Cheek. In today's episode, Reeds, we will be joined by the Swiss composer of ensemble, chamber, and site-specific music, Mauro Hertig. Tongue in Cheek is voiced and led by Tim Simmons, Aaron Lehman, and Emma McCormick Goodhart.
That's really extreme, you know, because what you want to do is just keep it neutral, as if you were just talking.
You're blowing across an opening, some sharp aperture, some sharp hole usually, and the splitting from that hole of like some of your air, you know, going on a tangent over the lip of this, and some of it passing into the closed tube or open tube, is what, you know, is actually like the spark of vibration.
Yes.
Right? And so that's one thing that's going on, is that air is being split. And I think that that's kind of like, I think a really beautiful way of thinking about what a reed is doing. The other thing that is going on, because flutes, although might be woodwinds, a flute is not necessarily one that has a reed. So there are flutes and there are reed instruments.
Yes.
And ones with a heteroglottal reed are like the clarinet, like the saxophone, like many other things that we'll get into, like the oboe and duduk and the Iranian sorna, or the kaval from Anatolia. These instruments are not only cutting and splitting the air, but they are also vibrating in themselves.
Yes. So one of the things that has interested us most about the concept of woodwinds is not just the the idea of the reed itself, but the sensitivity to the particularities of the material that is required to make a sound. And this is true of the reed. It is also true of the flute, or anyone who has tried to blow into a bottle to make a tone, that it requires this sort of rigor of understanding the particularities of this instrument. And so what makes reeds do what they do is that they are fibrous, and the structure of the reed itself is made up of cellulose and lignin and xylan, and it forms these very long, stiff fibers that go up and down the length of the reed. And when this sort of glottis or tongue is made to vibrate against the body of a human mouth, it causes bendings and oscillations along the lengths of those fibers. And so just to think about the idea that there are pleasant sounds made by the encounters between this plant body and a human body is just to think about, I mean, right here in this room, the level of sensitivity required between two different types of materials, that the chairs we're sitting on are creaky and plastic and make lots of noise if we move around. The tabletop here is made of wood. It doesn't creak as much, but wood often does creak. And what happens within that is that these same fibers that allow the reed to bend and vibrate and oscillate the way it does and produce a tone and split air, is that those same fibers are in these materials. Plastic and wood are both fibrous materials, and that's part of what allows their flexibility. But sound is always part of this. When wood bends and creaks, what's actually happening is these fibers that are all in parallel, they're just all lined up like a stack of pencils. They all slide against each other. If you clasp your fingers together and sort of rock them relative to one another, there is sliding that happens between them, and wood creaks. It's these fibers resonating against one another in this way. And in that context, it's considered unpleasant. So these encounters between human and wood bodies can variably produce what's considered the sweetest tone of an instrument, or a really unpleasant creak when you're trying to sit here and talk on the radio.
Yeah, are you saying that those are kind of one and the same? That
yes.
They have different kinds of temperature, maybe, but depending on our expectation of them.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and plastic is the same. Plastic is flexible because it had the molecules of polymers that form plastic are all long and oriented parallel, mostly parallel to one another, and can bend and slide and creak for that same reason.
I'm curious to go on that for a second. Like, is there is there something about, I think we're going to get to this later in using a different word than control, but is there something about the ability to control something that's just close by but outside of yourself that differentiates something that's considered to be this beautifully sweet woodwind sound, let's say, versus a kind of creak that feels like it's just happening despite you?
Yeah,
do you think that has something to do with control in a way?
Control is a strange way to put it for me, because it's really the properties of this material outside yourself and its structures and its particularities that determines what you get to do. So far from you getting to control it, you are really just, you are really just allowing it to do what it can already do. It is a meeting on two different terms for, something that you might find pleasant, but certainly not control, because, it's dictating most of the terms.
Thank you.
So, as you know, or as you might know, that was the sound of a clarinet. That actually comes from Mozart's clarinet concerto in A major, which he wrote in 1791 for the clarinetist Anton Stadler. And so I just kind of wanted to go back to kind of a basic way of thinking about reeds, one being a clarinet, which is a single reed. And I'm just going to go through these quickly without saying much, but just so you can hear the difference. So that's a single reed, or, you know, an obvious example of a single reed instrument. Then we maybe move into double reeds. Double reeds like the oboe, the duduk, which I mentioned before, the Iranian sorna, the kaval from the Balkans and Anatolia. So let's hear just quickly in contrast, and I'll say less in between the next two. But we're gonna hear two different versions of double reeded instruments. This first double reeded instrument, the sarna, the Iranian sarna, is exposed. So the reed itself is exposed, and there's direct contact with the reed, and you can sort of think touching the wet of the mouth. And then I'll switch to another one, which is the crumb horn. And like a bagpipe, that reed is capped. So there's not actually a direct relationship to it. So we'll go through these quick. First, the sorna. So that's the sorna, this is a famous musician, Shamirza Mouradi, playing the sorna actually in 1991 in the Festival of Avignon. So now moving from the sorna, which again is an exposed reed, to a capped reed in a classic crumb horn, which you have a lot in Renaissance music. So that was a crumb horn. So a capped double reed, and that's around I think early 16th century music susato. So let's make a bit of a shift, knowing those, or having heard those different sounds.
Yeah, having heard some of those different sounds, I definitely, the term that comes to mind is being rubbed the wrong way, you know, which is, I think, I don't know, a lot in my life right now. But yeah, I mean, just this idea of two bodies that must sort of meet on like terms, this body of a piece of wood and a body of the human. And that contact can be, you know, either a song or a creak or, you know, here speaking into a microphone that requires a lot of you as a speaker. You have to lean into it. You have to not speak too wetly. You have to speak at the right volume. It's dictating a lot of the terms of this encounter. But personally, I find the sound of some of those woodwind instruments a little grating.
You mean the crumb horn?
Yeah, I mean a lot of them. I think a lot of people find the buzzing quality of saxophone in particular. I mean, Tim and I both played saxophone. I remember in sixth grade, it was like the cool instrument to play, so everyone wanted to play. The orchestra then had like 20 saxophone players, and every song the orchestra did was just this incredible buzzing din because of the saxophones. But yeah, I mean, I think it sort of makes me think about just the idea of rubbing someone the wrong way. Get contact between encounters can, just because of the qualities of the parties involved, be very unpleasant or pleasant. You know, it conjures up the idea of good and bad vibes, good and bad vibrations. And yeah, and on that sort of note of being a little jarring, we have a contact mic here to listen to some of the sounds inside the objects we have around here. And we like to play with the contact mic, but it itself can be a little annoying and jarring because it picks up just about everything that requires any sensitivity to use that mic. So right now, Tim is rubbing a leather-bound red book against the plywood table. I wonder, Tim, if you can press into the table, if we can hear some of those wood fibers sliding against each other. No, it won't happen. But I do know what will creak. It's the chairs.
Maybe bring it to my chair.
Wood a lot recently. I do know the dryness and wetness of wood can affect its ability to creak or make certain sounds a lot. And that's actually something really relevant to reeds, which is that people who are highly sensitive to the playing qualities of reeds can prefer different types or makes of reed depending on the year and depending on the general level of humidity and climate factors. Climate factors play a big part of reeds. Tim's currently wetting the table. Most reed instrument players can tell you that when you are about to play, you have to warm up the reed in your mouth. You have to let the saliva get into it to give it the particular playing qualities that might be most desired. And there is a term that I encountered in researching this called alkali attack, which is there are qualities of the saliva that actually help break down certain structures in the reed to give it the ideal playing qualities. And it must be properly wet in order to play. So we're going to hear now an oboe player talking about oboe reed adjustment and playing different sounds depending on how the oboe reed is set up.
So, yeah, where are we? This is Meg Cassell from St. Pete College in Florida, so I'll leave it to her.
Needs to be somewhere around a C. When that bend in the tone happens, that's telling me that I have vibration in the middle part of my reed. It's also telling me that I will have the ability to be flexible enough to maybe make intonation changes in the upper register at the end of a long phrase. So this is a functionality that I need in my read. Crow, which ideally is a double octave sound. Crow is produced by putting a semi-loose embouchure around the bottom part of the thread. Okay, so I'm going to do that now with a brand new reed. This reed was scraped the other day. It has not yet been played or peeped or anything. I'm checking for leaks by sucking it a little bit. You hear that little pop? It's good enough for me today. It's peeping at about a C sharp, and it feels really tough to play. Oh, and it doesn't crow hardly at all. So, I'm going to look at it in the light. Everything looks pretty good. The first place I will go will be, because the crow is so high, I'm going to make a scrape across the heart, very even, from one side to the next. And I'll do that on both sides of the reed. My objective here is to lower the crow. So I'm taking a tiny bit of cane out of the middle part of the reed, provided there's enough in there to begin with. It's important in your rough scrape to not take too much cane off the heart. Okay, all I've done now is one even scrape across the heart on either side. The crow is still high, so I'm going to do it again. The very same adjustment. I'm careful to do
we talked a little bit already about
short, conservative scrapes. Hey. You can never put cane back on, but you can always take a lot off. So I'm very conservative. Notice now that the crow has dropped. In fact, the whole reed has gotten easier to play. So at this point, I'm going to put it in my horn and see what it does. The tone is strange. It feels strange. So the next thing I'm going to do, because the crow is now good, I'm going to now start the tip of the reed, and I'm going to thin the sides of the tip very carefully, just the sides of the tip. I'm leaving the middle part of the tip exactly as it was. It's important to not scrape clear across at this point. Because the center of the tip is a very important part for the stability of the reed. And the sides are going to help focus the sound and make it a little bit easier to play.
Make more sense to just talk. I did some research on the ova, on the history of it, and when the moment actually happens in the capsule. Because I think it's a decisive moment, also there is an additional element to it.
And I just talked about captain.
About what?
Captain. Closed and unclosed.
Predictably. The crow has now gone quite a bit lower. So because it is no longer a double octave C, I'm going to clip the tip a little bit. Clipping the tip will give the reed a little tiny bit more resistance, which won't be bad. With that tiny bit of clipping, you can hear that the crow came back up to a double octave C. The peep now has become very smooth, comfortable sounding, and a comfortable feeling.
So we're back. That was Mary Cassell. This is just from YouTube, but her explaining her oboe reed adjustment. And now we're back here with Mauro Hertig and little Idu, his son. And here with us, and me and Aaron. And so we wanted to have Mauro on. Mauro and I did something together yesterday, but we've been, in talking about reeds, here's somebody that knows a bit more about maybe a terrain of music that Aaron and I are a little bit novice to, but try to do our research into. But anyway, we got into a conversation about the oboe, and Mauro told me in particular about a certain history of the oboe,
right.
Something that comes just before it. So we can maybe just start there with what is that instrument that you had mentioned?
And
then we can kind of build from there.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a tourist in the field too. I'm a composer, and I kind of visit instruments every then and then, but I can't play most of them like properly, so I have to do my research every time, and for this time I did it too, to find out about where it actually happened, that moment when the modern oboe was developed. Exactly, yeah. And there's an ancient type of double reed instrument which was already used in Greece and Rome in ancient times, and even further back to 3000 before Christ.
Mm.
And they probably got lost, the knowledge got lost, but it was redeveloped probably in Asia and Byzantine, and was then reintroduced in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And in Europe during Renaissance, the time of Renaissance, there were musicians who would play many different instruments. So they weren't as specialized as the musicians today. In kind of the classical music. And Edu is doing the rounds here.
I'm not getting any love.
Edu.
And so in order to have an instrument that is easy to play, they had a capsule that was put up on the double reed or around the double reed, which it was a wind-closed capsule, an air-closed capsule that you just had to blow up the capsule with air. And when you have the right pressure and the right velocity of air, the double reeds would start to vibrate, and you would have a sound.
Is that similar to how a bagpipe works? Do you know?
Yes. Yeah, it is, because the bagpipes, you blow it up, and as soon as you start to push the bag, I think he's fine. He's just doing his thing.
So
it starts early. And the moment you start to push the back, that's the moment when the reeds start to vibrate.
Right. So, but that's the reason I ask is a bagpipe is calculated to let out that exact pressure between its bag and the reeds.
Right.
Right. Because the reeds are not close to the mouth. The reeds are on the other side.
Right.
Of the.
Yeah. Totally. And the way how to do the pressure is of course with the arms and not with the mouth. Mm. But basically this instrument that is called the poma or pommer in English is an on-off instrument. So there is no way how you can influence the sound significantly. It's basically no tone or full tone.
Thank you.
what's you know interesting here, and also relevant to like when you actually play a reed instrument with your mouth, which requires really particular embouchure, which is just the positioning of the mouth against the reed. There are very particular conditions that have to be met, and it's sort of you're more meeting the reed on its terms in order to make these sounds.
In which one?
In both, and, you know, that this very particular pressure has to be met. You know, I'm sure you can't, you know, push air out too quickly or too, you know, or not enough.
It seems that, like from what Mara had mentioned the other day, that actually is a definitive thing in the history of moving through, I guess, Baroque music towards. What we have maybe more now in classical music of like an obsession with coloration of sound and loud changes in volume, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Where like this, what's the old instrument called?
Shalma? The shalmai or shan, sham in English is kind of the overall family, also the ancient instrument, whereas this one with the capsule is specifically the pummer.
The pummer.
Pummer
is the one with the capsule.
P-O-M-M-E-R.
Oh, thanks. Keys? Where'd you get those? Are they your keys?
Yeah, the pummer, it seems like, I mean, the reason I say that about coloration is that the pummer is just on-off. Like
exactly,
say,
yes. And
so you can't have any coloration.
No, you can't. The coloration comes from how the instrument is built. Mm-hmm. And probably depends a little bit on how humid the air is, and how warm it is. The wood, of course, reacts a lot, especially with the double reeds, on the surroundings. And as you say, it takes a lot of skill and a lot of preparation to actually make a double reed sound with your lips.
Yeah,
I don't know if any of you have played it. I've tried and I've like failed miserably. I've never actually managed to get a sound out of a double reed, like single reed. It's fine, like clarinets and saxophone and so on is okay, but double reed is really difficult.
The double reed is something almost more unto itself, just in terms of being an organ that makes sound, than the single reed. Because unlike the single reed, the double reed is actually, it's vibrating against, the two reeds are vibrating against each other. It's not, you know, just player and reed, you know, with the reed vibrating through the wind. Sounds like the distinction is much more that part of the sound is the reeds hitting each other.
Yeah, that's like kind of exactly what I think is really interesting about this Palmer instrument, but also maybe all double reeds, as you say, and this difference between like an obsession with coloration of sound and uncolored vibration, let's say, even if it is colored. That here's a way of thinking about an instrument that is not an elongation or extension of the body, but as an externalization. Here is an object that, like we were saying the other day, is so near. It's very near to us, and it's close, but it's not. It's not attached.
Yeah, it's not attached, and it's certainly not tailored to the human body at all. It is the human body that must tailor itself. It's funny, you know, just as a related anecdote, I learned that the entire history of like the soul patch, the facial hair, comes from jazz, from instruments, players who are mostly playing the saxophone. But it is such an uncomfortable instrument to actually contour your body to, that they had to develop a type of this style of facial hair that made it more comfortable to play.
It's like a cushion.
Yeah, it's a little cushion for a reed, but you know, of course. Now it's like its own cultural thing, but it emerged so that the human body could contour itself to the reed more comfortably.
I think in going in that, I don't want to cut you off, Mara, but maybe you can anecdotally pop in here and there. But I kind of want to do this exercise since we have just 10 minutes left. I guess we have actually maybe 15 or 20 minutes left. But
yeah, we started late.
Yeah. Or do you want to start us off with a little anecdote about empathy?
Yeah, so there's talking about Egypt and children right now, there is a great story from, I guess you call it the Old Testament, mm-hmm. which is that Moses, who was raised by Pharaoh, was an infant and reached up towards the glistening jewels on Pharaoh's crown. And this was taken as an incredibly bad omen, that this child, this Jewish child who was taken into the household of Pharaoh, would one day unseat him and take his crown. So Pharaoh's advisors, some of them advised him to kill the child immediately, and others advised him to instead gauge whether this was something just that a child would do, or, you know, by chance, or if it was actually some sort of bad omen. And they suggested that he put out a bowl of hot coals and then a bowl of glistening gems and let Moses choose between the two. And clearly Moses started to go towards the shiny gems, but the story goes that an angel, I don't know which one, came down and pushed his hand to the coals, and Moses grabbed the coal and put it in his mouth. And for the rest of his life, he had a speech impediment that made it difficult for him to speak. So his brother Aaron spoke for him for most of his life. That most of what we read that Moses spoke was actually being spoken through someone very close to him as his mouthpiece, as an externalization of his words and will, who understood him well enough to contour himself to what Moses wanted to say or intended to say, and to actually voice it.
So maybe towards that, in the idea of speaking for others, which I feel like is attached to a certain form of empathy, obviously, or speaking through others in a certain way, without necessarily thinking about it as inspiring someone, but a coal burnt mouth being a transmission to somebody else's mouth that can actually speak. I wanted to do this exercise. I originally sort of heard a version or tried a version of this from Janice Brenner, who teaches at Juilliard. She's worked with Meredith Monk. She's a dancer. She's a choreographer. She's a vocal coach. But I've sort of since heard different versions of it and have tried out different versions of it. So I think Aaron and I will do this. If Mauro and Edu they can also join, because I think it might be nice in its polyphony. So the first thing to do, let me think this through again. So the first thing that we're going to do, and you can all do this with us also, but you do need somebody else with you. I'm going to mouth a word. I'm going to slowly mouth a word. I'm going to imagine a word in my head, and I'm going to mouth it. Both of you, or all three of you, Edu, you're included on this. All three of you are going to try to just anticipate what I'm about to say and say that word. So you have to watch my mouth. I'll try to step a little bit further from the microphone so you can see. Again, you're anticipating what I'm going to say when I say the word, right? So I'll start off with one. Ready? Tomorrow.
So I have to try and do it before you voice it?
Mm-hmm. Try to do it. Try to do it as I'm voicing it.
Okay.
Ready? I'll do another one. House.
Warm.
Yeast.
Oh, we have the same one.
Really?
You have yeast?
Yeast. Yeah, I said yeast too.
Yeast or yeast?
Yeast.
Yeast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do we both think Tim wants to say yeast?
All right. Ready? Yesterday. Sister.
Sander.
I said, yeah, I don't know what I said.
Can you see my mouth?
I can.
Yeah, I can see your mouth.
Yeah, it's all good.
Paper. Quinoa.
Hammer.
Did
Did you say callus?
Cactus.
Oh, I said callus.
Computer.
Cumberger.
Cumberger? Is that a thing?
No, I said hamburger. It was you who said a cum. I don't
know. Hinder. Form. Okay, now let's try another one. We might come back to this version of it, but now this time I'm not going to say the word. I'm just going to mouth it. So, a little truer.
But we say it.
But you say it.
Pork. Form. Push. Worm.
Fudge.
Well, I can't curse this. Was it? Yeah. No? A fudge.
Farce.
Fudge. Fudge.
Furnish. Fush.
Let's go back to the ones where I voice it. Ready? Fish.
Fish.
Oh, was it? That was too. That was quick. Fang.
Fish.
Fang.
Fang.
Fang. Wrench. Wrench.
Friend.
Electric. Try to catch up.
It's hard.
Yeah, but now it would be, because now there is a sound from the start, so I'd just be following your sound now.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you can use it as a cue.
Okay.
So I'm giving you a little cue.
And then we guess what the rest of the word is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Radio.
Okay.
Aperture.
Now.
Did.
Broadcast.
Brosnan. It's interesting, you know, there's just like a huge amount of, far from control, it seems like these things involve speculation on the other thing.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, at best, like, speculating on what the material needs or wants, or a person needs or wants, and trying to contour yourself to that.
And also the influence of Tim goes kind of back and forth, at least with me. I don't know how it was for you, but I kind of have a first thing that triggers my word, and then I continue to look at your lips or listen to your sound, and with that my word can change and become possibly weird also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Should we expand this a little bit to objects? I mean, we were talking about that before, but if this, you know, this, I think this really beautiful story of Moses burning the inside of his mouth, having pushed coals into his mouth and being mute, actually, except that his speaking came through Aaron's mouth, right?
Yes.
How do we think about that in terms of, I mean, what the position of Aaron is? How do we think about that in terms of other bodies? I mean, here we have it in terms of like other bodies, like other people, right? In the supposition, I think you said is the word you use, right? Like a sort of
speculation,
yeah, speculating into somebody else. I mean, I think it's actually really wonderful to have Edu's voice in the background here, because there is something that's, to me, also, you know, similar in that, in terms of certainly his age.
Yeah. And something also that I, before we had the kid, there is this idea that you have in your head what it's like to have a kid. And you get this idea that we talked about with the oboe, of the externalized body. That's kind of a mini you, mini me. But it, from the start, it's been nowhere near. It's really, it's literally right from the start. It's a different animal. It's a different being.
Different person.
And I thought about it just today, because we talked about it yesterday, Tim and I, and actually music, there is a development quite recently in contemporary music where instruments are not either an externalized body or part of the body of the performer, but where there are instruments that are built that are their own organism, like they're algorithmic instruments that you can only control to a certain degree, that react to the ensemble or to the rest of the music in their own way. And I feel like that is much closer to to what a baby actually is.
It's interesting. Yeah. That they, I mean, that again gets rid of our idea of control, right?
Yeah.
Or this term control, that it's not.
It's diffused.
It's diffused. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing that, I mean, Lucy, you know, who's playing later tonight, once said to me when we were talking about synths, which is she considers a deeply material thing, that you're actually sort of setting up material conditions and can think about the music materially, and that an algorithm, much more like the cellular structure of a piece of wood, is its own logic, and maybe not logic, but it is its own will. And you can certainly set the stage, but it will do its own thing, and you have to sort of, you're just like along for the ride. That maybe, you know, composition and music has more to do with the material particularities of what you play than about you.
Yeah, I think we don't have a lot of time, probably, I imagine.
Yeah.
For me personally, from how you grew up, how you're educated as a composer, is more from the side of you control things.
Yeah.
You make a score which produces the sound, or for some people the score is the sound, which is a bit stupid, but and I feel like the score, which is what we do as a composer, what we create in classic music, is more of a simple contract, but it can be between you and the musician, but it can be done extremely varied. It can be an extremely wide range of what you can do with this, and and it doesn't have to be a control. It can be a proposition. It can be a plateau on where you meet with the with the instrumentalist.
Yeah,
which is things that I've been trying more recently. And you can also just ditch the score and do verbal instructions. A good friend of mine, Matthias Monrad Müller, he does video scores. So his pieces, you learn them by watching a video, and then you go on stage.
Which
actually gives you a lot of advantages in terms of showing sounds, showing movement, something where you always need compromise when you put it on paper and in video.
Do you see that as similarly kind of autonomous then, the score, in the same way that you were talking about Lucy's material, like the materiality of a synth, or you were saying the kind of autonomy. Obviously, the immediate autonomy of a child in a certain way, and the immediate autonomy of certain kinds of instruments that are not not just there may be something still to empathize in, but they're not necessarily extensions or externalizations or, you know, mimicking copies, but they are their own autonomous things. I wonder if those scores are similarly have that kind of autonomy.
I feel like they do, although I don't want to open up a new bucket now because it would, because it gets kind of complicated, because you have both instruments that can be complex, and then you work, in addition to that, you work with people who are anyway even more complicated, and those complicated people play complicated, possibly complicated instruments, so there's kind of a super wide range of what you can do with it, and maybe what you should.
Well, I want to end where we started in a certain way, which I think picks up very beautifully from this, which is with the a recording of the Georgian polyphony ensemble Bassiani, and in this particular piece, I think I heard something very close to this, if not this particular kind of high yodel. Which is entwined into their polyphony recently at the White Light Festival. But it makes me think of a similar thing, which is at certain moments, I mean, to me it's obvious that people that listen to certain kinds of polyphony and certain kinds of harmonizations that happen in space where there is almost a tertiary voice, right? There's another voice that happens from the meeting of other voices. It's no wonder that someone's going to think that there's a god or that there's something else that's speaking. But I was just so incredibly struck by this in terms of the ensemble Bassiani, which I think is quite fitting. So, and with that, thanks, Mauro, and yeah, thanks, Edu.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And
this has been fun.
Thanks, all.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Edu.
This is Tongue in Cheek, exercises for warming up our ways of communicating.
Tongue in Cheek is voiced and led by Tim Simmons, Aaron Lehman, and Emma McCormick Goodhart. First Tuesdays of every month, 2 to 3 p.m. on WGXC Waveform Radio.